What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Hey, football fans, it's Andrew Filippone, host of the First and Pod podcast. Join me and my co-host, three-time All-Pro Patrick Peterson, as we break down every game every week. New episodes drop on Monday and Friday mornings. Be sure to subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jeffrey Wright and Company. My name is Jeffrey Wright. You can follow me on Twitter, on X, at JWright929ESPN. As always, you can listen on the radio, dial 92.9 FM or 680 AM. However you want to stay up to date and you're away from the radio, you can always do so on the Odyssey app. Free to download, free to listen, stream anytime, anywhere. You can even listen on demand. Dennis Fuller's producing the program for us. Glad that he is with us. My company, as he is each and every Thursday on the program. I got to mute my Zoom mic. There we go. Sorry. He, of course, writes about college football and college basketball for CBS Sports. Follow him on Twitter on X at David W. Cobb. Cobb, good day, sir.
Hey, good day, Jeffrey. How you doing?
I'm doing well, my man. Let's tell everybody what we're going to talk about coming up here on the program. We, of course, will discuss the Grizzlies last night. Grizzlies knock off the Spurs after falling behind by 12 at the break. The Grizzlies put up 43 in the third, 35 in the fourth, and they knock off the Spurs 129-115. We also had perhaps maybe the greatest highlight that didn't count in NBA history last night with Ja Morant's dunk over Wembanyama. We'll discuss that, but I really wanted to start with kind of a comment that was made by Jaren Jackson Jr. after the games, because I found it at least noteworthy. So we'll discuss the Grizzlies to start. It is, of course, the halfway point now. The Grizzlies have played 41 games. So maybe, Cobb, maybe we'll give out our half-season awards, like what we're thinking about with the Grizzlies. You know, well, who's been the MVP? You know, best bright spot, maybe biggest disappointment. We'll discuss that here in just a moment. Also want to talk some college football playoff with Cobb. Eric is, I guess, Cobb, I guess in San Antonio, it's a little warm. Eric and the boys, they're heading out to the links today. So they're going to go play some golf. That, or maybe they did the thing that everybody does in early golf season. When you have the Hawaii swing, all you're thinking about is just playing golf whenever you're watching the Hawaii tournaments.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, absolutely. Hey, more power to him. And good on Eric for actually letting you know, because I don't know if you remember, there have been at least one, maybe more occasions where when I was on with you and Mark as a phone guest, I would forget, and then I'd be on the golf course, and then y'all would call me, and I would end up talking to y'all while I was on the course.
Eric has called in from the golf course.
I've taken probably five or six radio calls from the golf course in my day. I can't say they're always the highest quality hits, because you get the wind interference there, but I totally get it this time of year.
You're itching. Oh, so many good swing thoughts, everything.
You watch Kapalua, you get that itch, and then you watch this indoor golf league now, and
the TGL, come on,
fantasizing about the indoor simulator that I'm one day gonna have.
You can, of course, go to
Birdies. When I have a 4-car garage with like 12-foot elevated ceilings and all, you know, because that's totally going to happen.
But in our neighborhoods, there was a house that went up for sale, and in his garage, like everyone in our neighborhood basically has like the same house. It's just like painted differently, or maybe there's like a different front, but like it's hilarious. Like when you look at like the rooftops, you just see like every house looks the same. So we all have these detached garages, and one of the guys put in like a Foresight full simulator, and Aaliyah showed it to me, and I was like, there's just no point in my life where I'm going to be able to justify like $20,000 to put the simulator in. Plus I've got birdies.
You do have birdies, which is a phenomenal asset. Cause you get all the benefits of actually using the simulator without having to front the investment yourself.
Correct.
Eventually it's going to happen to me. I'm going to get sucked in by one of these commercials on Golf Channel, and I'm going to buy a, a $9,000 simulator set, and then just probably enrage Sarah by taking over, a quarter of our house with the thing. And it's gonna be a disaster.
Because the way particularly like that kind of technology is, like when it first comes out, nobody can afford it other than like multimillionaires. So like when TrackMan first came out, it was like 50 grand for like the souped up one. They're starting to get a little bit more reasonable, but it's still like, what's that price point where it's like someone like in me can actually do it?
Is
it like,
well, I think the cheap solution is this. You get a turf mat,
yeah.
You put it in your backyard in front of a net. And then you sync up like one of these little Mevo, advanced analytics trackers.
Yeah,
and you sync it up to your iPad. And then after you hit the shot, you look at your iPad and see where it went. Like that's like the poor man's version of a golf simulator. Like you could probably get that setup going for like $2,500.
Yeah, maybe that'll be my Christmas present to me next year, 12 months from now. All right, let's talk some Grizzlies. Jason Smith, by the way, going to join us during hour number two. As well, Tigers taking on Temple tonight. Cobb, potentially the last quad two game for Memphis on the schedule.
Yeah, but man, the resume keeps getting better, doesn't it?
The wins are holding up. There's no question.
I mean, Ole Miss getting it done on the road, beating Alabama. Missouri getting it done on the road, beating Florida. UConn's starting to find its gear. It's still going to get Leon McNeely back. So it's the Tigers are in really good shape. I would even go so far as to say this. If this year's Memphis resume were last year's Memphis resume, like if the resume had held up as well as this one is going to, I think they might have made the tournament last year even at 11-7 in the AAC. I think they could make the tournament at 11-7 out of the AAC this year. It'd be a close shave, but their non-conference resume is going to hold up so well, it looks like, that they could maybe even sneak in with that record.
So we did this exercise yesterday with Cerrito. If you're just talking about the wins, I think Auburn has the unquestioned best resume. When you look at it, it's like I think they've beaten like 3, 5, 7. Like they have the unquestioned best resume. After that, it's like a handful of Memphis, Marquette, Oregon. Like there's a legitimate case, like if you want to say they have the best, at this point in January, they have the second best resume. The problem is they still have that Arkansas State loss, which is really like metrically weighing them down. But if you're just talking about pure wins, like Memphis could be up there. Like they're one of, I think, three teams that have 10 quad one, quad two wins. They only have two losses, and I believe both of their losses are in quad one. Yeah, because it's Mississippi State and Auburn, duh.
Like, right. Yeah. Right now, today, that's true. It won't be true.
Correct. That's the problem. Once the Big Ten and the SEC start playing each other, then like that's everybody's just going to get way more opportunities.
Right. But the one we didn't mention too, Michigan State on a ridiculous winning streak right now. They are looking like a totally different team than they were in November. And you almost forget that Memphis beat Michigan State because that whole week was defined by the UConn win. And so it's like, oh yeah, you turned around the next day and you beat Tom Izzo. And at the time you're thinking, all right, Michigan State, they're going to sneak in. They're going to be a 10 seed. They're going to end up in a play-in game. But here they are looking like perhaps the best team in the Big Ten. So the resume is rock solid. Clemson's keeping it on the rails in the ACC.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. Which doesn't take much. I mean, I think the it's kind of remarkable. The ACC and the AAC, I mean, there's not a whole lot separating them right now. As bizarre as that sounds, I mean, it is the ACC is so bad.
Yeah, I mean, because that's to me like the real question is Carolina figuring it out or is Carolina just getting into ACC play?
Yeah, you're not gonna have an NCAA tournament without North Carolina. They're easily gonna get to 20 wins in this league. So, yeah, but are they legit? No, I'm not convinced. They have a lot of problems. They don't have much of an interior presence at all. But I will say, if you watch North Carolina, Ian Jackson and Drake Powell, their two freshman guards, really starting to come on strong. Like when they were in Memphis for that exhibition before the season, it was all about Seth Trimble. And he's still been good. But, I mean, what's changed for North Carolina since they played Memphis in that exhibition is that their freshmen are developing and turning into stars. So that's that's going to help them ultimately. But they're the only thing standing in between Duke and a potential undefeated ACC run for the Blue Devils, because Duke's just running through everybody.
Yeah, it is at this point. I think it's fair to say this. As much as Memphis's resume did not hold up last year, and that's not, it's not anyone's fault. Like, you can only schedule, you can schedule before the season. You don't know how they're going to, like, you didn't know Michigan was going to collapse like that. You didn't know.
It was a good schedule.
Yeah,
it was a good schedule.
They tried. But as much as it didn't hold up last year, it's holding up and aging well this year.
Yeah, that's huge. It's huge. So you want to see them go out and continue to dominate in the AAC. I mean, you have to inspire any sort of faith or confidence in what they can accomplish in March. But you can kind of rest assured that even if they do hit a rough patch, and I wouldn't put it past them. I mean, they played some close games, right? Like, they had no business letting ECU back into that game last time out. There's warning signs. Like, there are some caution lights flashing right now for Memphis basketball. But you can rest assured, even if the bottom falls out almost to the degree that it did last year, I still think you're getting to the dance, you know, absent a, you know, catastrophic run of injuries to your backcourt. Like, this team is going to be fine.
Yeah, I also think they have the unfortunate reality of, like, when you get into conference play, nothing can happen other than bad.
Yeah, that's the tough part about being in this league.
It's really hard. Like, to your point, it's really hard throughout the course of a year to not have, like, a flat period. I mean, I guess it's fair to say last year UConn never really went flat, but the year before, remember I think they lost like 6 of 7 or maybe 7 of 8. And like before they turned around, because they ended up being a 4 seed, right? Were they a 3 or 4 seed when they won the first title?
They weren't a 1 seed. Yeah. I think they were a 4.
Yeah. I think they were a 4 seed as well. And they had a period in January where they were not playing good basketball. Like, it's just really tough to avoid never playing poorly. And you're now in this league where there's kind of like tough, every road trip just about feels tough and sleepy. Like, UAB's got a good environment. Charlotte, I think, has said they've sold out at least their lower bowl this weekend, so maybe that will be a better environment. But I just feel like whenever you turn on ESPN Plus to watch the AAC game du jour, you're seeing like a half-empty gym with just no environment.
Yeah, so that's brutal. You know, you mentioned UConn. Well, they have all these natural rivalries in conference play, yeah, right? Even if they should dominate that league.
Well, I think it also really helps
against a Providence or a Seton Hall or somebody that they have a history with. Whereas with Memphis, it's just a bunch of, you know, whatever programs that there used to be a rivalry with UAB. Like, there could have been a rivalry developed with Wichita State if they had been able to sustain any sort of basketball success over the last decade. You know, FAU looked like it could be a rival there under Dusty May, but he's gone now. So it's like, you got to find a way to get up for all these games, and then not just get up for the start, but then to keep your foot on the gas when you develop a 16-point lead. And that's hard to do when you're playing all gas, no brakes with limited depth like Memphis does. So, I mean, they're going to lose some games in this league. It's, you know, the KenPom chances of them going undefeated are 10.9%. So they're not going to run the table. They're going to take some losses. And the trick in deciphering whether or not this team is going to be the same as last year's or different is ultimately going to be how they respond when they do. Because it was around this time last year when you started to see the snowball effect transpire. And the end of January is when the bottom fell out. And so it's like, when they do get picked off, and it will happen, how do they bounce back from that? And I would think, given the veteran leadership they have in the backcourt, they're going to bounce back a whole lot better than they did last year.
I think this team's unquestionably different, even though if you want to draw parallels, you can. Like, I think the reason why I think this team's different is this team, man, just feels a lot tougher to me. Like, last year it was kind of a team, like, when the going got tough, like, they kind of, like, folded up. Like, they had the Arkansas State game, I beg your pardon, with no effort. Like, that was a poor effort. And then I thought the second half against ECU was not a great effort. But to me, like, that's a little bit different than going gets tough and we get going.
Well, it feels like a team. You know, last year it was like a group of hired hands, a group of one-year mercenaries, Naquan Tomlin, David Jones, just coming in here to try to get a bag and get to the league, you know, and didn't maybe care a whole lot about the program. And now you got a guy in PJ Haggerty leading the thing who could be with the program for another 2 years after this. I mean, that's the next. I mean, it's way too early to talk about this, Jeffrey. But is Memphis preparing the bag?
Because yes, they're trying.
You know that. I mean, that's they're going
to
come out.
Like, that's the other question, though. It's like, how much is that bag going to be? Because
whatever it is, it's worth it. Because you're going to be losing Tyrese Hunter.
I mean, it's entirely possible. I'm not saying I would predict this today, but it's entirely possible PJ Haggerty could be the number one player in the portal if he went in the portal. Like, you know what I mean?
And
because of size, scoring.
I think absolutely. I mean, we'll see who else gets in there, but you know, he's the front runner, I would think, for AAC Player of the Year. Think about Kendrick Davis, right? Like, he could have gone and played at a lot of schools.
Yep.
He chose Memphis. He was my number one ranked transfer in his transfer class.
Nailed that
so
one.
You look at a guy like PJ Haggerty. I mean, sure, he could be that. So they're going to have to prepare the bag for him. And then, it's way too early to talk about really get into the weeds of next season, but they're going to have some stuff to replace and put around him. But as for this year, it feels like they're more of a team. I think the guys getting to campus early, developing some chemistry, getting to know each other a little bit, I think that helped. Like, you do still have the midseason addition with the kid from Georgetown, Dante Harris. But it's not nearly as high profile as Naquan Tomlin was. And so you're not asking...
Nor the role. Like, you're not asking him to, like, basically come in and start.
Right.
You're asking...
I mean, I like where they're at. I think, that, like I said, I think they're going to take some losses, maybe sooner rather than later. But I think this team is far better equipped to bounce back.
All right, so Grizzlies last night, they knock off the Spurs. Really, the third quarter, by all reports, I think they might have gotten a talking to at the half, because honestly, I didn't think the first half was all that bad until the very end of the first half. Like, I thought they did a horrific job closing that half, and it goes from like a 4-point game to a 12-point game at the half. But it was clearly uninspired in the first half. I didn't think it was bad, but it was just uninspired. Well, then they come out in the second half, and like right off the bat, you could tell like it was like a 10-0 run, bam, like that. And they cut it to two. I think they went on a 13-2 run, maybe to cut it to one or something along those lines. But it was very clear they came out in the third quarter and they were trying to set the tone, and they end up outscoring them. Let's see, 18 in the third quarter. And then 7 in the fourth. So they outscore them by 25 to win the game. I want to talk about, before we get to Ja's play and whatnot, after the game, Jaren was speaking with media, and he said, we really needed that. And I thought that was an interesting comment, because normally when you hear the famous one I can remember is Mark saying, we really effing needed that. I can't remember if you were on the beat that year, if that was your year on the beat. Where like they'd lost like 12 in a row or 13 in a row. They finally get a win, and Mark was like, yeah, we really effing needed that. They've been on a road trip against Minnesota and against the Rockets. I believe they were slight dogs in both games, and they split. Last night they were, I think, 2.5-point favorites, and they come out and win the game. But the we really needed that, I thought was interesting, because I mean, a road split was not a bad result. And like in the NBA, these guys know, like, okay, there's nothing bad about that. I think what it's signaling is I think the Rockets' loss really, really got to them. I think that team has an impact on them.
Yeah, I think you kind of nailed it when we were talking last week about the Rockets emerging as that natural rival for the Grizzlies. You drop two to those guys. You drop two against Steven Adams and Dylan Brooks. And you kind of felt like in those games, Amen Thompson and Jalen Green were a better duo of young stars than your duo of young stars and Ja Morant and Desmond Bane. And if that got under their skin, then great. I love the fact that they've got a sense of urgency. They go into last night, they've lost 3 out of 4. They've lost 4 out of their last 6. You got your guys in the lineup, in the rotation. You got Ja, you got Dez, you got Jaren all playing. Santi's back. So the excuses are out the window, and you're going into the teeth of your schedule. You'd hope they feel some urgency and feel like their back is against the wall. And that's the way they played in the second half. And that was encouraging to see, because after those Rockets losses, it was like, I don't know if I see a team here with the Grizzlies that I would trust in a playoff series against a quality Western Conference opponent. But then last night we see the flashes in the version of Memphis that could really go out there and make some noise.
Yeah. And that's kind of a, I don't know if you sense it. I'm not sure how steeped into Grizz Twitter you are currently.
I try to stay off the For You page.
That's a smart move. That's a smart move. I would recommend it for everyone. But there's been heightened emotions. And I can't quite put my finger on it. I think there are a few things at play. Number one, it's kind of like we're winding down football season. And, all right, here we go. I think naturally you just find yourself, I know you don't, Cobb, because it's your job, but naturally you find yourself, this is the week that I feel like I always watch the most college basketball. When you get midweek, I go from casually watching college basketball to, all right, that's something to put on my TV every single night and watch that. But maybe it's the calendar turning. Maybe it's also the fact that the Grizzlies they've killed bad teams, but they've been barely 500 against good teams. And so there's kind of this weighing at you. They've not been particularly great against the West. They've dominated the East. But there's just kind of been everybody with a heightened sense of urgency or intensity the last few games. And maybe it's also as simple as this. The Timberwolves game, that is a big game for the Timberwolves. The same way that the Grizzlies, I think, because Harrington was telling us he covered that game. When the Timberwolves lost that game, there was an existential crisis amongst Timberwolves fans. Is it time to move on from Finch? Why can't we beat this team? There was a crisis moment. I think the Athletic even had a what's wrong with the Timberwolves after that.
Gotta love it.
So, yeah, I hate that for them. But whatever the case is or whatever the reasoning may be, it does feel like everybody's starting to get on edge a little bit. And I thought that was interesting last night for Jaren to say we needed that. And obviously they needed to play. I think they needed the second half. That first half was wildly uninspiring. I didn't think it was particularly awful, but they needed that. And then I also thought the other big thing was, I think you realize Ja's turnover rate is, 17.2% this year, which is the highest of his career. Now, there's a few factors for that. Number one, they've picked up the pace. But even if you do it based on 100 possessions, it would still be the highest of his career. Slightly, but it is the highest of his career.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, fewer minutes per game than any point in his career and more turnovers per game. Yeah. So, yeah.
And so there's also the new offense. You're playing with, he's been hurt too. And you're also kind of working in new rotations. You've got two new rookies in the starting lineup. I think there are reasons where it's not clicking on all cylinders and he's missed games. But last night was kind of a reminder. It's he turns it over twice, but I think, was it 12 assists to 2 turnovers?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
It's when he plays like that, they are really, really tough to beat.
Less is more with Ja oftentimes. 13 shots, yet he still finishes with 21 points, 12 assists. I mean, that I remember it during his rookie year. Obviously, November, December, he has this breakout period. He becomes their go-to guy offensively. The franchise begins to be molded in Ja Morant's image. And then there's a period of time midway through the season around this time where he started shooting the ball less. And there was some of this dissension or uproar about, oh man, Ja Morant's not as aggressive as he should be. He should be more aggressive. And it's well, no, actually, if you go and look, his downtick in shot attempts actually coincides with better offensive play for the Grizzlies. And I think we could be seeing some of that play out for this team this season, because when you have as many other dynamic options as the Grizzlies have offensively, and you run the system they run, you don't need Ja Morant hero ball until late in the fourth quarter, or late in certain shot clock situations. And, last night, he only takes 13 shots and the Grizzlies are all the better for it, scoring 78 points in the second half of that game. So, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong at all with Ja scaling it back. And then when the game's on the line, he was a bit hit or miss last night. There were a couple of ill-fated drives into the paint where he's looking for contact, doesn't get it. Kind of throws up wild shots that don't go down. But then you see the flashes of brilliance too with, obviously the dunk that didn't count is the headliner, but did you see that fake behind the back pass,
yes,
then the left-handed finish on Stephen Castle? And it's man, that's That's Jod is best. It's not even necessarily dunking on somebody. It's getting into the paint and then finding a way to finish at the rim. And I feel like I can't speak specifically to his stats when it comes to finishing at the rim this year, but I do feel like it's been a bit more of a struggle for him in the paint around the basket to just kind of get some of those acrobatic looks to go down.
Yeah. Jod's trying to make layups cool again, which is, you know, like that. I will say he might be the only player in the NBA that I feel like he can have a must-see layup. Like, we've seen it this year. Like
360.
Like, he's had, and just, like, some of the creative ways he's finishing, like, it's still electric, even though it's layups. I thought this was interesting, because I was thinking in the back of my mind, because I agree with you. Like, I think the peak Ja Morant game, like, forget, like, the fun ones of, like, going for 50, whatnot. It's like, okay, that's the NBA. Like, somebody's going to, like, great players going to go off and, like, but I think the most sustainable Grizzlies are at the best. Ja's somewhere in between like 20 to 25 points, and he has double-digit assists. If you look at it this year, in games in which he has double-digit assists, the Grizzlies are 7-1. Their only loss was the Brooklyn game. Was that the overtime game?
They played Brooklyn so many times, they all run together.
Yeah, it's the rare year where, because they were, Brooklyn was the NBA Cup replacement game. Like, you know, like when, if you don't make the knockout round, Brooklyn was one of the replacements. So they played Brooklyn three times this year. Other than, like, to me, it's like that kind of speaks to it. It's like you see last night, I think it was 21-12. Like, those are the games, it's like, that's when I feel like he's in complete control. Now, I also want to be fair and not overreact. Ja, like, if you go and you look historically, Ja eats the Spurs alive. Like, they, for a while, Pop was kind of had the strategy of let Ja get his and then stop everyone else. Like, if Ja goes off, like, those are, because I think Ja's first 50-point games against the Spurs, like, he consistently eats against the Spurs. I still just think, though, like, if they focus on that formula, Ja's getting everybody involved, that's when I think, like, man, this team is really tough to beat.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be Ja Morant hero ball. Speaking of the Nets, did you see they scored 67 points in the entire game?
When you told me that, like, I had to go and look to make sure it was true. I was like, I thought that had to be a typo.
They scored 32 points in the second half at the Clippers. Meanwhile, the Grizzlies scored 78. In the second half against the Spurs. So the fact that the Grizzlies lost to the Nets this year will forever confound me. I'll never understand that. But, you know, like, last night's win was big for the Grizzlies. And I think why you're seeing that heightened sense of urgency and that angst within the fan base is simply because of the increased degree of difficulty in the schedule over these last couple weeks. Because, as you mentioned, they did a great job of blowing out inferior opponents during the first couple of months of the season. But now you get into this January run of fairly tough games, and it hasn't been perfect. Like, there have been some struggles along the way. And so you needed a win like last night's win to sort of validate where you're at. Now the trick is, can you follow it up? Because you get this weird thing where you play the Spurs again. So it's,
and they've flexed it into the national TV spot.
Yeah.
Also, I don't know how you feel about this. My wife was last night. She's like, if you really did say Victor Wembanyama is an alien, she's like, I'd believe it. She's like, he doesn't look like any other human being. If he could come out on Friday night and shoot another 10 threes, please do. Because I thought, like, once he, like, started settling, I was like, oh, thank God. Because,
you know, it's,
sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's crazy, though, because he finishes with 13, 12, and 8 blocks, and you're like, that wasn't even a good game.
Correct.
For Wimby.
It felt like all his stats came in the first half.
Yeah, and then that dunk, man. I mean, you can't tell me that Wimby didn't challenge that, or that Wimby didn't try to defend that dunk as if it were an actual
attempt. So I've watched it many, many times. Here's what I will listen to. If I think he probably would have fouled him without the whistle, but
he did foul him.
That's true. In the end, I don't care. Like, in the end, it's still like, you can't take that away from us. We saw it.
it happened. It's going to be on every highlight reel of John Morant's career from here to all eternity. And nobody's going to remember in 10 years that it didn't actually count. I mean, it was sick. It was nasty. I mean, it was maybe the best highlight of John Morant's career solely because of who it came against. Victor Wembanyama, as you mentioned, an alien, 7'4". What's his wingspan?
I know, 35 feet.
Right. I mean, it's ridiculous. So
it's whatever. It's the entire. I know this. It's the entire width of the paint.
And I know it didn't count, but I think it counted in terms of the emotional lift that it gave the Grizzlies to finish out that game. I mean, the way they closed that game was magnificent. So, yeah, I think it counted from an emotional standpoint and maybe getting Ja in the headspace of like, hey, like I'm back. Like I'm, you know, I might not be having the best year of my career, but we still got a whole second half of this season to go. I mean, hey, maybe we look back in 2 months and we say, the dunk on Wimby that didn't count is where Ja Morant's season took a turn for the better.
I think it's possible because it clearly, like, it lifted his spirits. And, like, Ja is someone that, like, I do think dunking to him matters. Like, dunking on people matters
to him. Did you see Santi go full surrender Cobra at the bottom of the screen?
Marcus Smart had a good – have you seen that? That's the other great thing about a highlight. When you start getting, like, the multiple angles, like the next day on Twitter when you're starting to see, like, people that were just, like, filming it on their phone, like when you start to get the alternative angles, that's another like great way to relive the highlight. Marcus Smart, like on the sideline, was pretty like he truly had like the look of shock, like he could not believe what he just saw.
Yeah, it's special. I miss getting to see him up close, and I mean it was a short time, but I'll always just cherish it. My favorite in person Ja Morant dunk moment was in Phoenix his rookie year, when he threw it down on Aaron Bane.
Oh, yeah.
Across his body, jumping across the paint, game on the line. And that was like a breakthrough moment for the Grizzlies because Jaren actually cleared the paint, which is something Taylor was trying to get him to do all year. Clear the paint after you set that pick to give Ja room to operate. He did it, went to the corner, enough space for Ja to get down there and throw it down. And just he just does things, man, that are – I mean, as much as Wimby is an alien, I mean, Ja Morant – John Morant is a drone. I mean, he takes flight and stays in the air. I mean, he needs to have FAA clearance, man. It's just insane what he does.
It feels like gravity does not impact him in the same way that, like, NBA athletes are ridiculous in terms of, like, running, jumping, all of it. And he is, like, it feels like part of, one of the moves that you'll see, like, him do at the rim is, like, when he pump fakes and then he'll raise up to get the defender up. And then he shoots it coming down because he hangs in the air so much longer. Like, that creates the space that he needs to get the ball over a defender. How many people can actually do that? Being like, I just hang in the air longer. Like, the only other person I can really remember, peak Derrick Rose. I remember when Pepperdine came to the Forum and played the Tigers.
That was
Tigers.
A big night for you.
Yeah, well, it was hilarious because my roommate was on the team. And Derek had like a drive to the basket. And this is, remember, everyone knows like Derek's the number one player, but this is still not like the Derek Rose mania didn't really take off until like March. But like everybody knew he was awesome. Just watching how quickly he elevated and got to the rim, like that's the only other person I can think of that's like that, like Ja, it's the same thing where you're like, how does he elevate that fast, that quickly?
So were you sitting behind the bench wearing your waves, waves paraphernalia that night?
Well, it was also like they had no prayer. Like we couldn't wait to talk to our buddy Gus like afterwards, being like, what was it like to like play a like real team? Because at this point, like Gonzaga's still running the league, but Gonzaga hadn't like broken through to like the Final Four level. They were just like, he's like, we've never seen. He's like that. That was what we think would have been like scrimmaging an NBA team.
I love it. I think Vince Carter might be another comparison just in terms of the way he was able to elevate and levitate and create while airborne. You know, obviously late career Vince was a totally different beast. Speaking of late career, man, seeing Chris Paul out there last night,
yeah,
kind of blew my mind. 39 years old, like I have all the respect in the world. He's still an effective player even at that age.
Yeah, because at first when you hear 39-year-old Chris Paul, you're like, is he broke? Like, has he made bad investments? And like, what? Why is he playing? But you're right. He's still completely competent.
Yeah. You know, but Chris Paul and Mike Conley, the longevity, I think, is associated with sort of their anti-John Morantism in the sense that their games have never really been predicated solely on their athleticism.
Well, I think
it's so like long term.
That's
like,
a real question about Ja. I think, like, in the end, how much of the he's been hurt every year, how much of that is just it is a undersized guard that makes his living in the paint?
Yeah, right. So that's the evolution of Ja Morant will be fascinating. And it's not something that I don't think we have to worry about it for another 4 or 5 years, barring a catastrophic knee blowout, you know, knock on wood. But can a healthy Ja Morant be as effective into his mid to late 30s as a Mike Conley, Chris Paul? Again, we're talking about something that's a decade away. But, you know, that is something when you see that matchup of Ja Morant versus Chris Paul, it crosses your mind a little bit. Like, what is the late career Ja Morant style of play look like?
I know it always annoys some people, but I still think the best comp is it Russell Westbrook?
No, I hope not.
Because, like, that's another guard that was never a great shooter. I think Ja's peak is better than Russ's. Whatever, I know Russ has a MVP where, like, they just, you know, they let him get every rebound. Like,
triple-doubles used to mean a whole lot more.
Yes, I think a lot of stats used to mean a whole lot more. Like, that's kind of the other thing. It's like, I think also we've let stats impact way too much about what we think about players. Like, I was thinking about this during the wild card weekend. How many really good quarterbacks do we have? Like, because that was what stood out to me. It's like, Josh, like, to me, it's like we have Mahomes who wasn't playing, Lamar, Josh, and Burrow's not in the playoffs. Like, those four, I think you put them on any team, and they're winning, and they're good. Beyond that, it's just kind of like who you talk yourself into. Like, in, I mean,
what do you got to see from Jaden Daniels to put him in that category?
So I said Daniels, for me, is in the same category that Stroud was in last year, where it's undeniable. Like, when he gets the ball in his hands and you're on the other side, you think he's going down and scoring. Like, to me, like, that's... If you truly are afraid of that player, that's a sign of something. I got to see him do it again next year. And it's like one of those ones where I said, like with Stroud, I don't even need it to be like a whole full season to validate it. But, like, you know, you need to see like a month of play at the same level. And you're like, all right, that's it. I'm open to the idea. I also never know what to do with Stafford. If Stafford plays like he did in the first half against the Vikings, like, I think the Eagles are on upset alert.
Yeah, he's a Jag plus. He's more than just a guy, but he's not going to go out there and single-handedly win you the Super Bowl. Whereas I think guys like Pat Mahomes, Josh Allen, and like, you know, they're more or less capable of doing that.
And obviously, I'm a Goff guy, but like, that's kind of the other problem with Goff is he does something that really no other quarterback right now in the NFL does, which is like basically runs the NFL. Like, when we hear NFL pro style offense, it's actually what the Lions do. Like, Jared gets to the line, gets them in the right play, like checks to runs, like he controls the game at the line of scrimmage, play action, like making throw quick throws. Like, he is the most elite game manager, but he's also like has talent too. But like, I never know. It's like, I don't know, does Jared, how many teams does Goff work on? I don't know.
Yeah, a system QB, whereas the guys you mentioned in that truly elite system are system-proof. You put them anywhere, any system, they're going to thrive. I don't know.
So I just got me with stats. It's like, I don't know. Like, it's like everyone's just like focusing on Herbert. Like, it's not even like I don't even need to take the victory lap. It's like he is who I thought he is. He's a very good quarterback. He is not a great quarterback. He is not elite. He is not in that tier. And he has a bad habit of, in really big games, playing very tight. We've seen this all the way back to Oregon. And on top of that, like, I just feel like, I don't know what his Madden awareness score is, but it should be low. I feel like there's no quarterback in the NFL that is more surprised to see a third down all-out blitz. It's like every time he just gets corralled. Like, it's like he can't believe they did it.
Sounds like you're describing Quinn Ewers to me. I mean, that's my... that's my question about him at the next level. I mean, I think he made a wise decision to go ahead and declare for the draft, because I don't think this draft class is very strong at QB outside the top two. And I think next year's draft class actually could be pretty good.
Oh, have I told you my new dart theory?
You think dart's going to be a guy?
No. Dark. Like, this was my brain went into a very dark place.
Okay.
Again, we've only seen him start two non-important games, but I've talked myself into, like, if I tell you, what is the best case scenario for Shador and for Cam? Like, I think they're clearly 1 and 2, but, like, part of the problem that I'm having with both of them is, like, what is their ceiling? It's like, is Cam's ceiling, like, better Kyler Murray?
His ceiling is Jaden Daniels-esque.
I just don't think he's as big. And Jaden is like, that's the other thing about Jaden Daniels. He's so elusive. Like, Cam is a very good athlete, but he's not that. Like, I honestly thought one of the biggest plays of the game that Daniels made was the third down where he just avoided, like, guy blitzes. He's right there. He just shakes him. The guy just grabs his towel. And it's like one of the saddest images you can see where the defensive lineman is just running with his towel in his hand. It's like, and it's almost like he's so elusive. It doesn't even matter that the Commanders' offensive line is, like, not that good. It's like they can let somebody through. It's like, okay, Jaden will make that guy miss, and that's just one less defender to worry about.
Yeah. Well, it's not a strong class, so they're going to go 1 and 2 sort of.
But, oh, sorry. My dark theory is I now want the Giants at 3 to take Travis Hunter or Abdul Carter, whoever the actual best player in the draft is, take that person at 3, suck again, and give me, I need another Manning in a Giants jersey.
Ooh, I love it. I love it. I was kind of theorizing about next year's draft class. I think Arch could be that guy, but there's a whole bunch of other quarterbacks in college football next season who I think could step up and end up being first round draft picks. I mean,
Nico could take a step.
Lenora Sellers, man, at South Carolina. I'm buying stock. I am buying stock on him.
I will buy stock as an elite college quarterback. He does not throw the ball well enough to be an NFL guy.
Yeah, but we were saying that about Cam Ward, you know.
My problem with Cam has never been the way he throws. It's
decisions he makes.
Yeah, but, like, in terms of a pure passer, I've always been a Cam Ward guy.
Well, and real quick on Shador, the arm strength is not phenomenal. It's average, but he is a great decision maker.
He's a very good decision maker.
I mean, he was pressured regularly at Colorado and continually got the ball out. I mean, look, he took his share of sacks and he had to work on getting the ball out quick, but, like, he makes the right read. Like, I agree.
Very rarely
Sanders is a really, like, fundamentally sound, like, mentally strong, like, quarterback prospect.
I agree with you on that. It's rare that you see Shador goes to the wrong spot. Like, in terms of, I totally agree with you on that. I have some arm strength questions. My biggest problem, though, is, like, I think Shador is going to be very market dependent. And, like, Shador in New York, I don't think is going to work. Because I think Shador's thin-skinned. And I think there's a reason why Eli Manning has been the most, like, if you look at the Giants quarterbacks that have been good, it's usually the guy, like, Phil Sims. Guys that, like, don't let things bother them. And, Shador's got rabbit ears. Also, though, is he going to be the next quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys with his dad being the coach? We'll discuss that during the list. When we come back, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're at the halfway point of the Grizzlies season. Let's talk about what we think the MVP of the season's been, how we'd grade the season thus far, best surprise, biggest disappointment. We'll do all that when we come back right here on Jeff Rett & Company, 92.9 FM. Coming up next, we'll get into the list. We'll mention the Deion Sanders to the Cowboys, Ed Werder, with a report. We'll discuss that and more from the world of sports. Jason Smith also going to join us during hour number two. But we've now hit game number 41, Cobb. Grizzlies are 26-15. Good enough for third in the West. I think, like, if we're going for the first half grade, for me, I'm going with an A-, where I think it's clearly been that they're clearly a top half of the West team, and really, I think they're, at this point, I'd be surprised if they fall in the standings below fourth. That's kind of where I am, and so far, like, all that is good. The only reason why I keep it from A to A plus is I still have not seen enough consistency against the really good teams. I think what is very clear to me at this point, when they go up against an average or a below average team, like, they're going to wipe the floor with them. That's what they've shown. But what we've seen against the better teams is more inconsistent effort.
Yeah, I think with a tougher schedule, it might be more like 22 and 19 right now as opposed to 26 and 15. So for that reason, I'd go more like B plus. Granted, when you look at the run of injuries they had, with Ja in particular missing significant time along with a litany of other players, 26 wins is pretty impressive. So I honestly give the front office, if we're giving the front office a grade, an A. Because where is this team right now? What is the record today if you don't find Scottie Pippen Jr., if you don't have Jay Huff, if Jalen Wells isn't a rock-solid addition as a second-round pick as a rookie who's able to come in and start games for you in the first half of his rookie season, if you're not able to bring back Luke Kennard, you know? So I think the front office, for all the criticism they sometimes get, I think they deserve an A for the fact that this team has withstood those injuries.
Yeah, I think that's more than fair. I mean, they have yet again proven their ability to find value in the draft, real value. Like, that clearly is a skill set of theirs.
Yeah, and it the list kind of is ridiculous, but when you're not even bringing back for sure a Jake LaRavia, and you're in a position as a franchise where you can kind of decline, you know, his option, that I think tells you about the depth. And there's a lot of teams around the NBA right now who would love to have a Jake LaRavia as their seventh or eighth man. You know, and here he is, and the Grizzlies are like, you know, we might be able to do without you.
Okay. Is there any way that the MVP of the first half of the season is not Jaren Jackson Jr.?
Got to be. He's their best player this season.
Yeah.
And notice I didn't say John Morant's playing badly or John Morant's having a bad season. Jaren Jackson Jr. is just that good. He's been the sustaining force for the Grizzlies during the first half of the season.
The Grizzlies have played 41 games. Jaren has played in 39 of them.
He's the MVP.
And on top of that, like, he's been really good. And I do think maybe last year going the way that it did and him having to become, like, option number one offensively because they didn't really have any other options, I think that really helped him. Like, his efficiency numbers went down last year. But yeah, while he didn't have, like, a great game last night, like, there have been plenty of times this year where, like, they've called upon him and needed him to be the offensive engine, and he's delivered. I just think he's playing awesome basketball right now.
Did you see the story from Keith Smith, who does contract breakdowns on NBA stuff, about Jaren? And basically, the Grizzlies really need him to either win Defensive Player of the Year or they need him to make an all-NBA team so that they are able to structure his new contract with certain incentives that you can only offer if your player reaches those thresholds. And if they're not able to do that, there's a scenario where he hits unrestricted free agency after next season. It's complicated because it's one of those CBA minutia type of deals. But yeah, I didn't realize until I read that, and it's a good piece from Keith Smith, that it breaks down. Like, it would be really beneficial for the Grizzlies if he were to get some of those accolades.
Yeah. Harrington has pointed this out. When the Grizzlies signed Jaren to the extension, it was kind of a good and bad. Number one, it was going to be, for that contract, it was very team friendly. Because essentially, Jaren's coming off the injury, he wanted the guaranteed money. The problem is, because of the declining value, the year-over-year value, it was going to make him harder to sign an extension because the extent without those accolades that you're mentioning, basically, I think the Grizzlies, like, they can offer, like, the standard bump from the last, and there's no way Jaren would take that. Like,
right, because he would be eligible for so much more,
correct,
as an unrestricted.
Correct. So it was one of those things where it's a good deal at the time. It also is going to make it more difficult to re-sign him.
That's an interesting subplot to the season. I think he's an all-NBA player, but I don't know that Jaren gets the due around the league that he deserves because, you know, even coming out of last night, you know, it's all about Ja. It's all, I mean, the dunk, right? Like, the marketability of Ja Morant via social media, just via merchandise. He's got his own shoe line. He's on commercials. Like, his marketability is in another stratosphere from Jaren's. Yet here we are talking about Jaren as the MVP. And so I hope when it comes down time to vote on these things, if not defensive player of the year, then surely he's going to be all NBA because he is unquestionably an all NBA performer. I just don't know if he's an all NBA face or around the league.
Yeah. And it's like, why is it? And a couple of theories that I've heard is number one, he doesn't have like, he's not a guy that's going to have a highlight reel of dunks and stuff that's like attention grabbing. I even go one further. I agree with you that he doesn't, like, nationally, he doesn't get his due, at least in like the NBA media space. I think even locally, he's underappreciated. Like, I know, like, we're so conditioned as a city. Like, we want our bigs to just have points and rebounds. And he's never going to be like an elite rebounder. But still, it's like when you watch, it's so obvious. When you go to the game and you see like what all he does on the defensive end, like if you just watch possessions, it's unbelievable what they ask him to do. It's like control the paint, close out on corner threes, like switch on basically every screen. Like it's unbelievable what they ask him to do.
When you think about the level of endearment that this era of stars, you know, has within the Memphis fan base, I don't think it's quite to the level yet of where the core four got with Mike Conley and Tony Allen and Zach Randolph and Marcus Gasol because of that grittiness, because of the way they literally, you know, built the franchise into something that Memphians could be proud of. And as great, I mean, John Morant is head and shoulders better than anybody who's ever put on a Memphis Grizzlies uniform. And I think Jaren Jackson Jr. has arguably been more productive and a better player than Zach Randolph was even at his peak in Memphis. But yet I would still think that in the Memphis, you know, fan, to the typical Memphis fan, those core four guys still have a level of endearment and love and whatnot and connection that this group of stars doesn't quite yet have.
I would even go so far as to say, I think Dez would win a popularity contest.
Yeah, it's crazy. There's actually some like Grizzlies fans out there who are like, I could do without John Morant.
Well, like,
because they're still trying to like, he's still trying to win back their trust a little bit.
Well, like,
you know?
I think back to two summers ago with Connor, we would do a Grizzlies trade per day. And I can't remember, was it maybe to get Jaylen Brown? There was one of like the mega deals. And it was like, to make the deal happen, you're either going to have to include Jaren or Dez.